Accession number 33891.
Reel 9.
Gary Garrett's reel 9.
Okay, well, we're up to a point where I'd finished my York training, now joined my squadron, which was based at Abingdon, but I really joined them where they were at Wunsdorf on the Berlin airlift. And being a Johnny come lately on the airlift, to me it was just some exciting job to do for a couple of months. But about 50 years later, I was asked to give a talk on it, so I thought I ought to do a bit more research to find out what it was all about. And I came to the conclusion that the airlift foundation started during the war when Stalin had made up his mind he wanted Berlin and the rest of Germany. But go back a bit. During the war, the three great men, Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin, get together and discuss how they were going to beat the Germans. And when they began to see the light at the end of the tunnel, they started to discuss how they were going to control Germany. And initially, very easy, a north-south line dividing east and west, with the Russians taking the east, and the west then divided north and south, with the Brits up north and the Americans down south. But a little while into at the end of this conversation, Roosevelt mentioned to Churchill that he thought the Americans would only be there for a couple of years once the war was over as an army of occupation. And Churchill saw that this was going to give the Brits more work to do to cover the rest, so suggested that perhaps the French should be able to get in. So the French got a strip, which was along the American and French border of the new zones. Now, as an interesting sidelight here, if you picture troops, replacements, logistics coming from the States, they'd go up the channel and offload at France and go across France into the French zone and into the American zone. But that didn't happen. History will show that what happened, they went past up the channel, past Holland and Belgium, up to Bonn in Germany, and then down by train into their zone, adding several hundred miles to the journey. And the reason given, or hinted at, was that Roosevelt didn't trust the French and didn't want his supplies passing through French territory. However, back to this talk. One of the bones of contention on the talk all the time was Berlin. Stalin insisted that with it over 100k inside his territory, he should control it, but Roosevelt and Churchill didn't want that. They didn't want him to have this prestige, the kudos that went with it, and so there was a great deal of argument. And my understanding is that Churchill used a bit of blackmail and pointed out that thousands of sailors, many of them Brits, were sailing up the North Sea to Murmansk, and many of them dying on the way, to supply the Russians with arms. And the British government found it, the British people found it very difficult to understand why such a powerful country as Russia needed supplies from outside. And if they discovered now that there was all this argument about Berlin, they'd be, you know, very upset and I have problems. So Stalin gave in. And Berlin was also divided into four sections. Well, the war ended, and unfortunately, the Russians got to Berlin first, and immediately made it difficult for the three other missions, the French, British, and Americans, to arrive. Couldn't find decent accommodation, got to do mine clearance and things, but one of the major stipulations was that all the Allied forces that were now in Russian territory had to be out before he wanted them to move. You can picture the war ended with a more or less line of the advancing forces and the Americans just outside Berlin on the wrong side. So it would take a couple of months before they were eventually got tired of waiting, all got into aircraft and flew in and set themselves up. And during that period, it seems that practically anything that worked, like a bike or a sewing machine or a pram, was on its way to Russia. So the first few months and first few years were fairly ordinary. The four commanders would meet once a month, talk about their problems, and then the Russians began to play their cards. The first thing they did was insist that everybody travelling between east and west had to have a visa. Time consuming. Then they started insisting that everything passing in the way of freight had to be licensed. The only thing that could be excluded was stuff on military trains. There were three ways of travelling by train between the two: the state railway, and trains run by the engineering regiments of the Americans and the Brits. And there's a story of one American train arriving, several carriages full of freight, and the back one having 10 Germans aboard who had no visas. The Americans making the point that they were working for the Americans and therefore didn't need visas. The Russians wouldn't have it. Lots of argument. The officer in charge of that particular military train sent a message down to the driver, start up and go, and off they went. But in the meantime, the Russians had detached the last carriage, and the 10 Germans were left behind anyway. On the next occasion this particular officer came up, there was a flat top between the freight and the passengers. And sitting on the flat top, machine gun, Americans, lots of soldiers all over the place, so the Russians didn't argue on this occasion. They said, go, go. But they threw the points, and the train finished up on the buffers inside the siding, just inside where they'd started from. Meanwhile, we were doing things they didn't like. Firstly, with the martial aid, we then organised free elections. That's something that the Russians had was unheard of. And in fact, the chap who won the president or the mayorship of Berlin was a chap named Ernst Reuter, who had been a communist, and when he saw what was happening in East Germany and East Berlin, decided no more. But of course, the Russians then refused to talk to him. So whenever there was a meeting in which the mayor had to be involved, the messages had to be passed through his deputy. They also did silly things in the air. They used to, going back to the Russians, they started making dummy attacks on aircraft. And there was one occasion where a yak hit a Viking on the airways. Everybody aboard killed. The Russians insisted upon the inquiry being held in Russian. And of course, nobody was held to blame as far as the Russians were concerned. But the crunch came when the Brits and the Americans decided, now that they had elected a parliament of their own, they should be allowed to have their own currency. And they would dump the old Reichsmark, Hitler's money, and introduce the Deutschmark. Stalin used that as an excuse by saying this would create a terrific black market between the two sides, barriers down, everything shut off, no trains, no lorries, no cars could get across the borders anywhere. And 2.2 million Berliners on the west side were cut off from any form of supply. The only way in, by air, down the three agreed international airways. Well, somebody worked out that to feed 2.2 million Germans, a half a pound of food per day and nothing else would require 2,000 tons a day to be flown in. Now, that excluded medical and anything else that was required. And at the time, at Wunsdorf, which was then the sort of headquarters of Transport Command in Britain, in Germany for the RAF, there were six Dakotas capable of carrying 2.5 tons, but during the airlift, this was extended to 3.5 by stripping out everything unnecessary. And three of them took off, and about 8 or 9 Americans from down south took off, and about 80 tons were delivered on the first day. But all went to the forces in Berlin that needed them. But the build-up started. I think the best thing to say that between then and December, there was a terrific game of musical chairs between aircraft being moved from one base to another. But by December, everything had been patched up. Everybody was on site in the right place at the right time, sort of thing. And the interesting thing is that in June, July, by the end of that, 70,000 tons had been flown in. And in December, 140,000 tons blown in, which was pretty good, because that's not good flying weather in that time of the year. Now I'll try and give a word picture of the layout of what was going on in West Germany. Try and do a word picture.
That'd be fantastic.
Okay, so what we had was 8 airfields in West Germany, and only three airfields in Berlin. And in fact, when the airlift started, there was only two. Tegel did not exist. They started to build it in May, and the first aircraft landed there in November. But there was eight airfields, and starting way up north was in Schleswigland, in the Schleswig-Holstein Peninsula, was RAF Schleswigland. And try and position these, try and picture Berlin with three hour hands coming out, one pointing to 10 o'clock, one pointing to 9 o'clock, and one pointing to 7 o'clock. And they would call those A at the top, B in the middle, and C. So above A was Schleswigland. On the border of the two zones and near the Baltic was Lübeck. And almost in a parallel line from there at Hamburg was Fuhlsbüttel. In Schleswigland there were six flight refueling aircraft, Lancastrians, owned by a chap who in his service time had led the Pathfinders. At Lübeck there were nine Dakota squadrons with Canadians, New Zealanders, Aussies and South Africans flying, as well as RAF. And at Fuhlsbüttel, all, as I say, north of this A point, the civil airline were all the civilian airlines. And during the airlift, 25 different airlines came under contract, not all at the same time, but at the end of the 1948, the Fuhlsbüttel had two airlines we know well, British Airways, which was then British European Airways and British Overseas Corporation. We had Freddie Laker, who made enough money there to try and compete against the future British Airways and the American. A single Dakota owned and flown by one man and called the Trent Airline. And there again, half a dozen flight refueling aircraft. Now, all those aircraft, except for the flight refuelers, went to Tegel. Now, between point A, the northern head one, and the middle line, the 9 o'clock, were two airfields, Fassberg and Celle. These were fairly close to the border, but they had been taken over by the Americans, who had run out of space on their bases in the south. And if you followed the 9 o'clock line out for about 50 kilometres, was Wunsdorf. And then you drop right down to the bottom last line, the C line, and follow that on for about 100 kilometres or more, you come to Wiesbaden and Rhein-Main, which were the American bases. Now, here we have, as I say, eight airfields to supply three airfields in Berlin and, outside Hamburg, flying boats who were landing on the lake. And it was very simple. It was a case of where, when and how. Where? All the airfields that were north of point A, the top one, the 10 o'clock hand, all went into Tegel. The ones between A and B and Wunsdorf all went into Gatow. And the Americans all went into Tempelhof. There was only one major, well, two changes to that, of course. The flying boats landed on the Lake Havel. And the aircraft from the two bases that had flight refuelers also went into Gatow. The reason being that Gatow was fairly close to Lake Havel, which is a huge lake, and they ran a pipeline from the airfield to the lake and pumped it straight into barges, and the barges were used to convey the fuel through canals and rivers into the various parts of Berlin. So that was where to go. Then it was when to go. Oh, blast.
You were just saying, you were saying why, I think, weren't you?
Yes, where to go, where to go, well, now we're on when to go. Every base was given a time, or a series of times, at which they could land at their particular airfield. So they knew they had to go to Tegel, shall we say, and they knew exactly what hours were specifically for them. And then how, everyone had a particular flight path to follow in West Germany, which kept them away from the other aircraft. And last but not least, everyone had different heights to fly. For example, the Skymasters were at 2,500 feet, we in the Yorks were at 3,500 feet, and then above, every 1,000 feet above that, were the Dakotas and the Hastings and so on, each one specifically allocated. So the point, chances of collision were very remote, and of course there were no collisions. So that was the situation. Now perhaps, shall we say, talk about the life of a crew. The first time allocated to Wunsdorf was 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning. That was hours to land in Gatow. The flight was just about an hour plus, so the group flying the 20 aircraft in for that hour were called the 8 o'clock shift, just to make it easy to understand, it was 8 o'clock shift. So you'd arrive at the ops centre about 7:15. Each pilot stroke navigator would be given a piece of paper which allocated what aircraft number he was for, his sequence of takeoff, and the times for turning over the various points that had been allocated. So you got out to the aircraft, you did your checks, climbed aboard, got to the end of the runway and took off on the time allocated. But while you were doing that, your signaller would tune in to a radio beacon, because in the pilot's cockpit, looking at all his other ends, was a radio compass. So that would be, to me, pointing to the my right, pointing to about 2 o'clock, 2:30. So I'd roll down the runway, get airborne, start climbing up to 3,500 feet, and climb on to the arrow, which was slowly moved as I pointed towards it, and I was heading straight for that marker. Over the top, you get a cone of silence, then the needle would swing round and show you behind. So the navigator had a spot check time, and he could look at the time he was supposed to be there and tell me whether I was fast or slow. Meanwhile, the signal tuned into the next one, which we aimed for, same again, the needle turned, and then to the third one, which was at the entrance to the runway, to the air lane itself. And here navigation became even easier, because right at the end of the lane, right on the corner of Berlin, a place called, Fuhlsbuttel, I think, no, it wasn't, had a peculiar name, was a radar transmitter. So now the navigator had complete control of time, distance, to keep 3-minute gaps, very important that you kept those 3-minute gaps. A couple of funnies going down there. One, I remind you, being the very last of the Yorks on one trip, I went over that particular starting area about the same time as the first of the Skymasters would, and we flew at different speeds and we would be 3 minutes ahead by the time we got there. I couldn't see the Skymaster down below me, of course, through the floor, but I heard a voice come up, Skymaster 211, do you read? Yes, bub. Tell me, do the Russians have any Yorks? No, bub, don't think so. Why? Oh, one just gone a Russian past me. You can imagine those sort of corner remarks coming up. Anyway, 20 miles out from the radar beacon, you made a call to the approach controller. Now, each airfield had its own approach controller, of course. And you identified yourself by your aircraft number and type and what you were carrying. Reason to specify what you were carrying was that the approach controller was also, there was the motor transport controller was also listening in. And he got his lorries queued up in the sequence of what was coming in. So when you eventually landed and you were carrying coal, it was a coal lorry that backed onto you, so on. That was easily arranged. But there was one very nice story about this 20-mile call-up. 19 Skymasters had gone down, and then there was a break, which had deliberately been planned by the operational controllers, and the first York was missing. There was a 6-minute gap, and fixed into that was a Dakota. Now, the Americans had been calling up approach control and giving all their usual gen, and for the first time ever, for me too, a female voice came up as the approach controller. Very unusual. And being Americans, it was, what are you doing tonight, honey? What do you want from the PX? We can get silk stocking and all that. They never had a chance to meet the girl, of course. They were only on the ground for 20 minutes or so. But the girl was obviously getting a bit confused. And the next aircraft was a Dakota flown by a Canadian, and he had 28 passengers aboard. Soldiers, I don't know who they were, but they were being flown in together. And so this Canadian called up Romeo Juliet, 26 packs. And he'd also identified himself as a Dakota. And back came this young lady, Romeo Juliet, packs of what? And identified him as a Skymaster. Said, Skymaster Romeo. There was a hush for a little while. Back came the Canadian. Honey, 26 packs means 26 passengers. That was the abbreviation PAX. And again, identify himself as a Dakota. Back came the girl and said, Skymaster Romeo Juliet, are you sure you're a... And the chap said, just a minute, honey. There was a noise of rushing air. I took his mic off, I think. He said, honey, I've been outside. I've had a look. I ain't grown none. I'm still a Dakota. So that was amusement. Anyway, what was caught up there was all sorts of things. Coal, eggs, parcels of food, spares for the ground crew, all sorts of things. On one occasion, I called up gin. I had 9 tons of booze gin in the back. Where it went to, I knoweth not, but I can well imagine. And there's one story, of course, we wouldn't have heard this because this was on the American side. 20 Skymasters going up, all called up, machinery. 20 tons, 20 of them each carrying, I beg your pardon, 40 of them, each carrying 10 tons or thereabouts of machinery, which when it was on the ground, was put together, and became a generating station for electricity. Because up to then, the Germans had been, shall we say, rationed for electricity. I think it was 2 hours a day initially, now 4, and this would be built up. And of course, the Americans also had bigger aircraft than Skymasters, things like taking in vehicles, ambulances, fire engines, all sorts of odd things that were taken in by them. So, you get to the point on the corner of Berlin, of Berlin, 3,500 feet, and you start dropping down to get to 1,000 feet on the approach line. Now, dropping down to your left was Tegel, and taking off from Tegel would be aircraft that were climbing up to go over the top of you to the start point for the outward lane. And over further to the east was Tempelhof, where the Americans were taking off and climbing up to 6,500 feet to go over the top of you and go out. Now, why the Americans went out down the middle line, same as everybody else, and then turned left to go all the way down to the south of Germany, I don't know. I had thought until I got my reading going that they went backwards and forwards down the same line. It made sense to go down one way and go one height, but no, they didn't. So in that little area as we were descending, there were aircraft going up and changing heights and all, and it's a compliment to the radar controllers that nobody ever had to report a near miss. It was like that. It was well controlled. Anyway, you drop down to 1,000 feet. Now, on my very first trip, of course, I didn't have my pilot. My co-pilot, I had a chap who'd done all this many times before. Typical transport command, first time you did a trip about that you'd never done before, somebody who had done it will go with you just to point out the odd tricks of the trade. And had he not been with me, when I got to my 10-mile point, I would have said, I'm going home, and poured on the coals and gone back, because as I started my descent from about 10 miles out, 1,000 feet, the other York was just touching down, and the moment he touched down, an aircraft in the queue waiting to take off rolled onto the runway. Now, in those days with piston engine aircraft, you spent quite a while on the end of the runway clearing your engines, and I didn't see any way that this would but no, he said, it's all right, be all right, carry on, because from then on you did a rolling takeoff. You just turned onto the runway and kept going. You never stopped to do as many checks as you could before you got on. Couldn't beat your engines too high because the aircraft sitting behind you wasn't too good for them. So that in fact meant that at the beginning of each runway during the airlift, where aircraft were landing every 3 minutes, they were also taking off every 3 minutes. And picture that going on 24 hours a day if it could. It never really came to 100% because it couldn't happen. Anyway, we landed. rolled to the end of the runway. By the time I got to the end of the runway to turn off to go to the parking place, the Skymaster went over the top of me, quite low, and then into the parking area on load. And before the engine had stopped running, the lorry was in position, doors open, and everything poured out. Normally you would have about 20 minutes to turn around, and you could go into the hangar where there was a thing called a Malcolm wagon. There's a club in the RAF organised called the Malcolm Club. It was built, and the money was paid for by a rather rich family whose son, a wing commander, Malcolm, had been killed, and this was in his memory. You can go and get a tea and bun if you want it. If it was pouring rain, you stayed where you were, sorry. But sometimes you were there, you were loaded up with something. Well, one of the most surprising things I brought out was electric light bulbs, because the Americans flew in the equipment to keep the Siemens factory operating, and we were taking it out to be sold in West Berlin. We also took mail out. Now, if you took mail out, you could always guarantee you were going to take passengers as well, because the post bag was stacked in such a way you could form seats, and people could sit on a pile of mail bags with a further pile on each side of them as a sort of shoulder protection, shoulder height, so they had safety. There was no harness, nothing like that. There's a lovely story about an elderly lady being taken out to, obviously on her way to hospital. When she got into Wunsdorf and got off, the transport to take her away, one of these army lorries that had steps up the back and a row of four seats down the side, and she refused to climb up the steps because she said the vehicle was too dangerous. Anyway, you took off after your set amount of time, got in the queue, and back to Gatow. That's a stopping point. So, you get back about 2 hours and 40 minutes after you left, very roughly, past the Daffy wagon, another tea and a wad if you wanted to, two operations where you would pick up your next flight plan, go back out to the disposal and get into your next aircraft for the 12 o'clock shift.